Welcome back to the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We are coming to you live this Wednesday, November the 8th. Now, we will take a breather from the election for a moment. I know everyone's thinking about it, talking about it, musing upon it, but I'd like you just to take a deep breath, and we'll come back to the election in about a half hour. In the meantime, we're going to be remembering Johann von Staupitz. Usually, if you've read any Reformation history, you might have run across this odd little name, Staupitz, and surmise some kind of connection between Staupitz and Martin Luther, at least an early connection between these two men. We're going to start out by finding out how pivotal Staupitz was as Martin Luther's father confessor in the Lutheran Reformation. Dr. Martin Noland is our guest. He joins us here in Studio A. He's director of the Concordia Historical Institute based here in St. Louis. Our call-in number is 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. And that in-studio email address, issues, etc, at kfuo.org. Marty, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for inviting me.
It's always good. You had a beautiful walk down the street.
Oh, it's just gorgeous out today.
It's unbelievable. You know it's only going to last for a day or two.
Yeah, only one day in St. Louis, yeah.
We're going to be talking about Johannes von Staupitz, and at least the final name there is, or his city name is, familiar to people who've studied Reformation history, but you're going to have to get us oriented here. Let's begin with the big question. How important is Staupitz, his influence, his early influence, on Martin Luther in the Lutheran Reformation?
There would be no Luther without a Staupitz. And that's not just the personal counsel that Staupitz gave to Luther when he was going through his struggles. Luther called him his Anfechtung. And he was key to that because he was Luther's pastor during these times of difficulty in which Luther was struggling with whether he was really saved or not. But even more so, and that's often not commented on, I think that Staupitz gave Luther his Augustinian theology. And that all has to do with the doctrine of election, of course, which we're all thinking about election today. So it's a key thing, but it really set Luther on the course theologically that would result in the Reformation.
So what does it mean to call, what's this relationship between Luther and Staupitz that we have characterized as father-confessor? What would that have meant early in Luther's career while he is still an Augustinian monk under the care of Staupitz, and then later in Luther's career, father-confessor?
As a father, well, see, Luther and Staupitz were together in the same monastery in Wittenberg. And it was during those years, Luther's first years from about 1511, well, up until the indulgence controversy. So a period of 6 years, the two of them worked closely together as colleagues. And Staupitz was the father, or he was the head of that monastery, and Luther was his associate. So when it came to matters of religion and personal life, Staupitz was Luther's pastor and confessor. So if there was a sin, according to the theology of the church, Luther would have to go to Staupitz. He was the one that was prescribed for him to confess the sin. But the sin that was bothering Luther was that he was angry at God, because it seemed to him that God was unjust. And this was a very difficult theological question. And it took somebody of the caliber of Staupitz, who himself had a doctor in theology, to be able to help Luther get through this, to figure out why he didn't need to be angry at God, and to give a good theological explanation for that. So Luther's personal struggles, the things that made him angry at God, and the struggles that he felt that he was not being saved or was not saved, that worked together with his theological development, and this was shaped by Johannes von Staupitz.
There's a triangle between Luther, Staupitz, and then the elector, Frederick the Wise, that eventually led not only to the Reformation in many ways, but also to the launching of Luther's teaching career as a professor of the Bible at the University of Wittenberg. Tell us about that.
Frederick the Wise and Johannes Staupitz were both members of the Saxon nobility. Now, your friend Uwe Simonetto is a Saxon, but he's not of the nobility as far as I know. But when you hear Uwe talk on the radio, you can hear that Saxon accent. That's a modern Saxon accent. Anyway, Staupitz and Frederick the Wise are probably boyhood friends. They knew each other from their boyhood days. And when Frederick became the elector and decided that he wanted to start a university in the town of Wittenberg, where he resided, he looked around the people that he knew and people had some ability, and he said, "Oh yeah, I remember. Yeah, good old John. Where is he these days?" And he asked his confidants and counselors to find where John was. Well, John at the time was, I think he was down in Munich, actually, and he was a member of the order. But he'd known that Staupitz had gone into the religious life. And furthermore, Staupitz had a doctor's degree by this time. He said, "Perfect. I'm going to get this man and get him to be the first significant faculty member of my new university and make him the dean of the theology faculty." And so that's how Staupitz in the year 1502 went from Munich to Wittenberg and began the course of theology there. And so then also when Staupitz, at just about the same, it was within a year, Staupitz comes to prominence because he has this position. Then the Augustinian order says, "Oh, this guy's pretty talented. We'll tap him to be our vicar general," which is like a bishop of the monasteries. And, suddenly Staupitz has a lot more work than he planned for because he's being both kind of like a bishop and a professor at the same time. And within a couple years, this is just way more work than he can handle. And so Staupitz then begins looking around in his own order for somebody who has an advanced degree, who can teach, and is kind of on his wavelength theologically, and he finds this monk from Erfurt, who's named Martin Luther. And so by request through Frederick, he asks Luther to be transferred to Wittenberg, and that's how Wittenberg gets its theology professor known as Martin Luther.
Was Staupitz theologically a reformer in his own right, even though later, even at Luther's request, he refused to associate himself fully with the reforms that eventually came under the hand of Luther? Was he a reformer in his own right?
That would not properly, in the sense that we talk about the reformers of the 16th century, it would not properly apply to Johannes von Staupitz. However, the notion of reform does come from the order in which, or I should say the chapter or the group within the order, which both Luther and Staupitz belong to. And this takes a little bit of explanation. The Augustinian order that they belonged to was known as the Augustinian Hermits, which meant they spent a good portion of their daily life in seclusion. We talk about Luther's room as a cell, C-E-L-L, and you can go there today, and it looks like kind of like a jail cell. It's not a big area, and they were locked inside for a certain period of time. The Augustinian hermits in Germany by the late 15th and early 16th century were divided because some of the Augustinian hermits felt that their order was too strict. And they wanted to own some property. You know, a lot of people came into the monastery kind of against their will, and so either as children or adults, and they wanted to keep the property that belonged to them. There were also some monasteries where the rule about going to dinner and to worship together was not always strictly enforced, and also the rule about seeing as little of the opposite sex as possible was not strictly enforced. So these were the type of, you'd say, more practical issues that divided the various monasteries, particularly in Germany. And so there arose a group of monasteries which became known as the German Reformed Congregation. And this group decided that they needed to reform the monasteries so they'd go back to their original mm-hmm. constitution.
So it was an effort to follow the Augustinian order more strictly.
More strictly. Mm-hmm. The order of the Augustinian hermits. And but not all of them wanted to do that. So some monasteries in Germany wanted the more lax way of following things, and others wanted to follow the strict rule. Well, the strict rule which is known as the Reformed, that's what Staupitz joined, and he became a leader of that group, and Luther also joined. And also at the time when Staupitz was coming to prominence, the leader in Rome of the whole Augustinian Hermits was a man named Giles of Viterbo. He was also a member of this Reform group. So they were all trying to get their entire order in line, to follow the order on all these matters of monastic practice. And so from the notion of Reform, which means go back to your original rule or your original doctrine and make your practice follow that, this was a constant thing on the mind of Staupitz and Luther and their colleagues.
Did that general idea about Reform, returning to the sources of authority, to the discipline, and then following that consistently, do you think that had a direct effect on Luther when eventually it would become back to the scriptures, back to what the doctrines delivered via the scriptures, and make our practice, in particular the preaching of the gospel, right administration of the sacraments, follow in line with those things?
That was, in my opinion, this is what led Luther to this idea of Reform. So he really took the idea, he borrowed the idea from the Augustinian hermit group that he belonged to, and he applied it to the whole church. Now, he was not the first to do this. In fact, there were cases and calls for Reform throughout the medieval period, but in Luther's own lifetime, very significant, at the opening of the Fifth Lateran Council in Rome in May 1512, this was just when Luther started his work at Wittenberg. This man named Giles of Viterbo, who was the head of the whole Augustinian hermit order around Europe and around the world, he gave a lecture or a speech to the Lateran Council and called for the reform of the whole church. Now, that sounds very, and it was an impassioned plea, and it's the one speech that is most noted by historians that Giles ever gave. I'm sure that it echoed throughout Germany among the Reform congregations. And I think that this is where Luther got his notion and certainly felt a need, maybe a calling from God, that this is maybe what God had called him to do, not only in the monastic system, but also in the church at large, because as a professor of theology, he had access to the whole church and not just to the monasteries.
We're talking about Martin Luther's father, confessor Johannes von Staupitz. Dr. Martin Noland is our guest. He's director of the Concordia Historical Institute based here in St. Louis. You can join our conversation, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Taking a little break from election talk to talk about this man of significant history in the Reformation. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. In about 10 minutes, Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois will join us for his election analysis. More particularly to Staupitz's theology, was his theology evangelical? Did it have, in the same sense that Luther's eventually would, a central focus upon the gospel of Jesus Christ, the good news of Christ as the propitiator for human sin, as the savior of all mankind through his death and resurrection?
Well, what you've just explained, the merits of Christ, was something that a lot of theologians would accept, in theory, anyway, in theology. It's in the practice of the church, in the sacramental practice, where they were almost all askew. But in this area is something that is where Staupitz does, as I said at the beginning of this talk, that he does push Luther in a good direction from our perspective and away from what was the dominant theology at the time. We can generally talk about this as the Augustinian theology. Now, so far we've talked about the practice of Augustinian monks. Here we're talking about the theology of Augustine going back to 4th or 5th century when Augustine lived, and specifically Augustine's work in writing and polemicizing against Pelagius. Now, Pelagius taught that people can be saved or recognized by God by their own good works that they do. And Augustine really hit that hard and said, we are not saved because of good works. We're saved because of the merits of Christ. And he also, when he got in debate with Pelagius, emphasized the role of predestination and election. This is Augustine. Now, in the Middle Ages, they all knew that Pelagius was a bad guy, but they wanted to compromise in some ways because they wanted to figure out how does a person come from the point of being predestined to their final goal of heaven and all the points along the way. And so they began making compromises. And the Augustinian theologians, and here we number Thomas Bradwardine, who was a professor at Oxford in the early 14th century, Gregory of Rimini, John Wycliffe, and then later Luther, Zwingli, and Calvin, all towed to a strictly Augustinian line on the matter of the doctrine of salvation. And Staupitz did too. Now, but that was the one thing that Staupitz had in common with Luther. Staupitz would not agree with Luther on the reform that he did on the rest, like the sacramental system and the papacy and all that other stuff.
He thought that Luther was abusing freedom in the gospel.
Right. That Luther just went too far and should have allowed a lot of those traditions, including monasticism, to stand.
Let's talk with Herman, who calls from Illinois. Thanks for being patient, Herman.
Thank you for taking my call. I was listening to the conversation, and Dr. Nolan was getting into my question here. The distinction between where Dr. Staupitz had a support and affinity for Luther's position and where he did not. Now, certainly, Dr. Staupitz, with the Augustinian, pointed Luther back to some fundamentals, such as Scripture, and those early church fathers who dealt with Scripture, like Augustine, prior to the unique claims exclusively of the Roman Catholic papacy and magisterium. We're certainly getting into some very important fundamentals of the church and Christianity. And when the Reformation started to mature, what further attitudes did Staupitz take towards Luther?
Thank you very much. It's a good question, Herman.
That's Pastor Harold Weber. I recognize him. And Harold, the actually, at the time of Luther's meeting with Cardinal Cajetan, and you can see it in the most recent Luther movie, Staupitz came down to Augsburg and tried to mediate the dispute between the cardinal and Luther and was unable to do that. At that point, Staupitz had to make a decision, and he decided to stay with Rome. And so he released Luther from his vows, which you see in the movie, which really meant that the Augustinians wanted not to take any credit or blame for what Luther was teaching.
But in a sense, releasing him from his vows, and this begins kind of a point of exile in Luther's life.
Right, exactly.
It also has at least a hand in saving Luther's life, because from this point on, he's going to be under the imperial ban, isn't he? I mean, to say you are no longer a part of our thing, go and be free, not only kind of gives him plausible deniability about Luther, but now Luther is actually free from any vow he would have taken there. He wouldn't be fleeing the monastery. He says, go, you're free from your vow. You're not going to be in any trouble with us if you go and do your thing.
Right. Well, it's a two-pronged sort of thing. And in Staupitz's, I think he made the right decision. But now after that, after the trial of Worms, Luther did try, and when he was back in Wittenberg, to get in touch with Staupitz, who by that time had been under pressure from a variety of people. They wanted to use Staupitz's influence on Luther to make Luther recant. And Staupitz refused to do that and began to get worried for his own safety. So Staupitz at that point left Germany, went to Salzburg, and joined the Benedictine order instead. And Luther wrote to him at Salzburg. Staupitz would not write back until the last year of his life, when he told Luther that he loved him personally as a brother, but he could not accept the Reformation as Luther had done it.
How did Staupitz end vis-a-vis his own church, the Roman Church? I know in something you've written that Staupitz's writings were put under the ban in 1559 by the Pope himself.
Right. So even though he died of a natural death, the Council of Trent, I don't know if they named Staupitz by name, but the index, that is the list of forbidden books, prohibited the Roman Catholics from reading Staupitz's work because they believed that his writings contributed to the Reformation. So even though Staupitz wanted to be a good son of Rome, Rome did not recognize him thereafter as a good son. They would have marked him as one, along with John Wycliffe, who held to a what they would call a radical Augustinian view.
Do you think that's a fair assessment on the part of the Council of Trent's index?
Well, if you understand the rejection, that the key of the whole thing is what is the role of man in his conversion? And if this is the key doctrine, which it is, it's the doctrine of free will and grace and all that, then Staupitz comes out on our side as Protestants. And so the index was correct. Probably Staupitz didn't realize the full, the conclusions or the results of what he was holding to. But his position was right, the reason he held to it, because that's what Augustine had taught, and he saw the echoes in Scripture.
What can the Church take away, with only 30 seconds here, on this day when it remembers Johann von Staupitz and his work?
I think what we can see is that God's Word continues to work in the hearts and minds of men and women, in spite of the fact when they are taught and surrounded by bad theology. And I think this is what happened to Staupitz and his colleagues, who, listening to the words and reading the words of Augustine and the Bible, came to a more biblical understanding, in spite of the fact that was a very minor theology. And from that, then, the Reformation burst forth.
Dr. Martin Nolan is director of the Concordia Historical Institute, based here in St. Louis. What is the Concordia Historical Institute?
We are the Department of Archives and History of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we're here on the Concordia Seminary campus. Our museum's open, free to the public, 8:30 to 4:30, Monday to Friday, and it's good to be here.
And you guys have a display on Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's involvement in military chaplaincy.
From Civil War until the present, and all four services recognized, and it helps you understand what the military chaplains do, and they really are a type of missionary and a very important one.
How long will that particular display be on?
That exhibit will be up till fall 2008 under current plans.
If you want to find out more about the Concordia Historical Institute, just go to our website, issuesetc.org. On the left-hand side, you're going to see the links. Click on it, and you'll find a direct link to Dr. Martin Nolan and the Concordia Historical Institute. Or you can always call them, area code 314-505-7900, 314-505-7900. Marty, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to be spending some time, a little more time, talking about, of course, the election, getting some election analysis from Congressman John Chimkus of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois. I do want to find out, now that all of it is over, more or less, how he weathered national attention in the scandal that was rocking the Republican Party before the elections, and then find out what he makes of the overall results and what's it going to take in Washington, D.C. now, and now that he is a member of the minority party in the House of Representatives. That's coming up here right after this break, and then Dr. Serge Trifkovic will join us at 4:45 for about 10 minutes. We'll talk about the impact of yesterday's election on the future of the war in Iraq. He's from Chronicles Magazine. I want to hear from you in the last 45 minutes of the program, starting at 5 o'clock. Your comments, your thoughts on yesterday's election. That's Open Lines in the last 45 minutes of Issues, Etc.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Here at AM 850 KFUO, it's a privilege to say thank you to our caring donors, including Ronnie and Patty Leifer of Redbud, Illinois, Stephen and Sheila McMichael of St. Louis, Tony and Elaine Gerner of Baldwin. Thanks for making the programs on AM 850 KFUO possible.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton from The Morning Show, providing you the information you need to get going in the morning. Plus, we play your inspirational Christian favorites and have great guests like Pastor Mark Hawkinson, Dr. Bob Weiss, Dr. Jack Fiennes, Ruth Cook, Pastor John Schmidtke, Jane Wilkie, Pastor Jolly John Lukomsky, and Marty Lindfeld. It's happening on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
We'll be right back. This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Midterm elections 2006 proved to be a mixed bag in terms of pro-family state initiatives. While South Dakota's ban on abortion took a hit, almost all state marriage amendments resulted in victory, passing by an overwhelming majority. Josh Montez has highlights from the ballot box.
Rob Regeer with the South Dakota Family Policy Council says pro-abortion groups in his state defeated the abortion prohibition by focusing voters on the ban's lack of a rape-incest clause.
We tried to beat them at their own game, trying to prove that there was a rape-incest exception in there, a limited one anyway. And instead of really focusing on why there shouldn't be a rape-incest exception in it.
On the other side of the coin, marriage amendments fared well. Virginia, South Carolina, Tennessee, Wisconsin, Colorado, South Dakota, and Idaho passed the measure by a large margin. Arizona's vote on marriage is yet to be determined. David Fowler is with the Family Action Council of Tennessee.
I think it sends a very strong message to our Supreme Court that judicial activism is not welcome here. I think it sends a very strong message to our legislature that the people in Tennessee care about marriages, they care about families.
Gary Bauer with American Values says state marriage amendments send a signal to courts around the country that America doesn't want rulings in favor of gay marriage.
And we also think that those state amendments might hold up under any kind of legal challenge that the gay rights movement might implement in the next few years.
At the time of this recording, the verdict was still up in the air for Missouri's Amendment 2, which, if passed, would legalize human cloning. For Family News in Focus, I'm Josh Montez.
Nevada, Colorado, and South Dakota all had initiatives on the ballot to legalize medicinal and or recreational use of marijuana. With most of the votes in, all three states appear to have rejected the idea. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO, join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We will meet Dr. Margaret Brand, who was married to Dr. Paul Brand. You may know him from the books he co-wrote with Philip Yancey. So we'll talk with Dr. Brand about her life. Vision for God is the name of the book, and it's the subject of the next Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
You can read an excerpt of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, titled The Great Jesus Debates, on our website, issuesetc.org. It's a book about the battle in the early church over the person and work of Jesus Christ. The Great Jesus Debates is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The Great Jesus Debates costs $14.99 plus shipping and handling. That title again, The Great Jesus Debates.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be getting some further election analysis from Congressman John Chimkus of the 19th Congressional District here during the next 10 minutes or so of Issues Etc. Congressman John Chimkus is a regular guest on the program. John, welcome back.
Hey, Todd. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I got to know, what's it like to win your race rather handily, but wake up to find yourself a part of the minority in the House?
Well, I didn't wake up. I was still awake last night, and it was already happening as we were gathering with our friends and supporters. And I've been at church. We've been going over the Book of Concord, and Luther was very strong about the role of government, but also that God is in control. And we need to be involved in the battle and in the public policy arena. And even when things don't go our way, we have to remember that God is still in control.
I think I heard someone quoting you earlier today saying that you did not relish the national attention that you got in the Mark Foley Page scandal thing. Tell us what that was like for you.
Well, it was. I knew it was a whirlwind because I've been around Washington long enough to see the national media exposure. I thought at most I would be under the spotlight for 2 weeks. Then I thought, well, maybe three. And really the issue went away from most of the candidates, most of my colleagues' races, but for those of us whose names, you know, were listed as somehow involved, it was an issue that I was asked every time I talked to someone in the media for 5 weeks.
We're talking with Congressman John Shimkus getting his election analysis. We do apologize, by the way, to our listeners for the audio quality. Congressman Shimkus is on a cell phone. He's speaking to us live from, believe it or not, Holy Cross Lutheran Church at a basketball practice. What are you doing at the basketball practice?
Well, I'm the sixth grade coach.
Oh. Okay, well, thank you for taking time out of a very important event there as well. What's your general reaction to last night's election results? At least as far as we know them, we're more firm on the House than on the Senate.
Well, my analysis is that the public at large is very displeased with the direction that we are moving. I think a lot of that frustration is with our involvement in Iraq. I think a lot of conservatives have been kind of upset, and they believe that we haven't held totally to our convictions and had to compromise in areas that we probably should never have compromised and stood fast on our convictions. And when you lose some of your base and the other side is mobilized, it's not a good recipe. Now it's just, I just got off a conference call with my colleagues, and, you know, we have to go back to Washington and finish this year. We have to reorganize. There's people running for the different leadership posts. It'll be a reevaluation of where we stand as Republicans, and that's what some of these leadership races are about.
The president earlier today, John, said that several times that he looks forward to working with the new Congress in January. He looks forward to starting some negotiations, conversations, seeking common ground with at least the projected leadership of the new House and perhaps the Senate. How realistic do you think the president is being about his ability in the next 2 years to work with a democratically controlled House and perhaps the Senate?
I think it's always important to understand that this government that we have is really based upon compromise. We wouldn't even have a constitution we have now if it wasn't for the large states compromising with the small states and having a bicameral legislation. So it's always important to say, let's talk and let's see where we can find areas of agreement. But there are two distinct different views of how a government should operate in a lot of the arenas. And, you know, it's our hope that that he stands firm on his values and convictions, and if we get rolled over in the legislative process, that we have the veto backstop to stop the country moving in a direction that a lot of us would not like to see it go.
Do you expect the president to pull out his veto pin in the next 2 years a little more than he? Well, it can't be anything would be a little bit more, but do you expect to see that veto pin a little bit more in the next 2 years?
It could very well, especially in. But it depends on the Senate, too, and the Senate can stop a lot of stuff just because of the filibuster and the, the 40-vote, 60-vote issue on calling the vote. So it's definitely a card to play to hopefully move to compromise on a lot of issues so that we do move legislation that is a bipartisan, bicameral piece that most of us can live with.
John, I want your response to something the president had to say in the press conference this morning. Really, it was the reason for calling this press conference in Washington, D.C.
After a series of thoughtful conversations, Secretary Rumsfeld and I agreed that the timing is right for new leadership at the Pentagon.
What's your reaction to the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense?
Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, I don't think a lot of people saw it coming because, for the most part, why people respect this president is that they believe he's a man of conviction, a man of his word. And just a couple days ago, you know, he was pretty strong saying that Secretary Rumsfeld is doing a great job in tough times, and he's going to stay. We know that Iraq was a big issue of this campaign, and getting a fresh start and a clean look at it through a professional federal public policy bureaucrat coming in who's been outside of government for a while might be healthy, but it just, again, took everybody by surprise.
Your colleague across the aisle, Nancy Pelosi, has already been talking about her first 100 hours agenda. There's a list of things she said she was going to at least attempt to do from her position of leadership there already. What can possibly happen in the lame duck session of Congress between now and January?
Well, her first $100 will be after January, after she gets voted in as Speaker. The lame duck will still be under Republican control with our 15-seat majority. We have, the spending bills that we have to pass. I'm not sure we can get much more done. If there's a Werder bill, which is the lock and dam bill, it's in conference. I'm not sure if that can get kicked out. We have other provisions on, I don't know if you can move anything on border security anymore. Refinery extensions. I just don't see. I think there's Democrats going to be, busy trying to reorganize and get ready for January. And, Republicans are going to be licking their wounds and trying to reorganize and figure out how to operate in the minority. And there's not going to be much room for really legislative achievements, I imagine.
So what do you think is going to be really required for the Republican Party to take, at least for the time being, in the House and perhaps the Senate, that position of loyal opposition?
Well, I think it's a recommitment to our values and making sure that when we can work with the Democrat majority, we work with them and we move forward. But there's no shame in saying, hey, there's no shame in casting a no vote and being able to explain it based upon public policy in the arenas that we have. I think the Democrats are going to have a hard time. And I mean, your listeners, they're bipartisan. They're Republicans and Democrats. They're conservative socially. A lot of these Democrats who ran in a lot of these new districts ran as social conservatives, and it's going to be up to their constituents to hold them in line as, Nancy Pelosi, who's a liberal, a social liberal, will try to move them and that party to the left. And it's going to cause all conservatives, whether it's the conservatives in the minority party or the conservatives within the majority party, to stand in the gap and not allow her agenda to be the agenda of the legislative branch.
Congressman John Chimkis has been kind enough to join us from his alternate position as sixth grade basketball coach in Collinsville, Illinois. He's congressman from the 19th Congressional District in Illinois. And congratulations on your victory, and keep up the good work.
Thanks. Take care. Appreciate your service.
I recognize that many Americans voted last night to register their displeasure with the lack of progress being made there. Yet I also believe most Americans and leaders here in Washington from both political parties understand we cannot accept defeat.
That's the president speaking about the situation in Iraq and its impact on the election. Joining us to talk about the impact of the election on the war in Iraq is Dr. Serge Trifkovic. He's foreign affairs editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture, and director of the Rockford Institute Center for International Affairs. Dr. Trifkovic, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. It's good to be with you again.
How big of a factor do you think the war in Iraq became for the Bush administration, eventually for the president's party in these elections yesterday?
Quite sufficient to cost him control of the House and possibly the Senate. We don't know the outcome in Montana and Virginia yet. But it only goes to prove that you can fool some of the people most of the time, etc., etc. His repetition of the old and rather tired mantra that things are getting better, that staying the course and not leaving before the job is done, had already worn out back in about mid-2005, I would say. And that his failure to understand that radical measures were called for cost him this election. Had he, for instance, fired Rumsfeld back in April, when it looked like he was under considerable pressure and when quite a number of former generals, including Anthony Zinni, spoke out against his pig-headedness and lack of strategic vision, I think that would have been a step in the right direction for the president to shift some of the blame on the architect-in-chief of the Iraq War. But doing it after the election is actually the worst of both worlds, because it makes the administration look weak, and at the same time it does nothing to affect the balance of power in what is increasingly looking like the lame duck presidency for the remaining 2 years.
The president said today that the reason he waited until after the election to make his decision on Donald Rumsfeld and to finally contact the parties involved was because he did not want to inject that decision that he called a political decision into the strategy of the war in Iraq. What do you make of the president's thoughts there?
Well, first of all, that's why I said he should have done it 2 or 3 months ago, when no such accusation would have applied. And also, no doubt that had he done it 2 or 3 weeks ago, it would have been counterproductive, because the Democrats would have gleefully commented that it was simply an attempt, a desperate attempt to rescue the election. But at the same time, had Karl Rove and co. concluded that there was some mileage to be gained from doing it, even on the eve of the election, they would have done it nevertheless. But in substantive terms, the question is, what will come next? I think that his choice of a friend of the old Bush team from the father's presidency and someone with strong intelligence connections is a good idea, because Robert Gates is not tainted by the Iraq policy. He had no impact on it. And also, the tension between the intelligence community, the CIA, and the Pentagon, that was due to Rumsfeld's consistent attempts to manipulate intelligence in order to, first of all, justify the Iraq war, the weapons of mass destruction, and so on, and then to manipulate the data concerning its course, may be overcome by having someone like Gates at the helm.
During his press conference today, the president was asked to respond to a comparison made between Iraq and the Vietnam War, and in the midst of that response, he had more to say on the war in Iraq, and in particular on the issue of whether or not Iraq is in the midst of a civil war.
You know, you hear all the time, well, this is maybe a civil war. Well, I don't believe it is, and the Maliki government doesn't believe it is. All our ambassador doesn't believe it is, but we've got to make sure it isn't by implementing a strategy which helps a political strategy which helps unify the country, and a security strategy which makes sure that the Iraqis are better capable of fighting off the extremists and the radicals that want to stop progress in Iraq.
Is this extremist and radicals, or is it civil war? Which, in your opinion, is the war in Iraq at this point?
Well, first of all, I don't think the designation civil war exactly applies, simply because a civil war, strictly speaking, is fought between people who belong to the same nation and whose allegiance to that nation is not in question. So the war in Spain between 1936 and 1939 would have been a civil war, because you had Spaniards of different ideologies fighting each other. Likewise, in Russia between 1917 and 1922. But in the United States, one could say that we had war between the states, because the Southerners did not consider themselves part of the same nation with the Yankees, and therefore it was not, in classical terms, civil war. In Iraq, the same problem applies. Most Kurds, actually, one could say almost all Kurds, and most Shiites do not identify with a unitary state of Iraq. And in that sense, what is emerging may be called more accurately war between the communities, primarily war between the Sunni community and the Shiite community, but a war it most assuredly is. Now, if we look at the pattern of violence in Iraq today, it is quite obvious that putting it back together would require some form of accommodation with the Sunni minority, which is about 22%, up to 6 million people, who provide the backbone of the insurgency. But death sentence that was passed on Saddam last Sunday will only make things worse in this respect, because even though if there is anyone who deserves to hang, it's Saddam, the trial itself was a farce. It was under constant political pressure from Iraqi government. One chief judge resigned in protest over these pressures. Another one was fired when he refused to accept that on a priori basis that Saddam was a dictator. And any number of Saddam's defense team were gunned down and were not provided adequate protection. So at the moment, what we have in Iraq is not only the violence that claims up to 1,000 lives every week, we are also looking at the impossibility of the dynamics of a coherent society, regardless of what the U.S. will do. Even if we have ultimately some kind of Islamic Republic emerging in Iraq, it will be based on the Iranian models thanks to the Shiite numeric majority. It will not be based on the consensus. And, of course, the Kurds already have their statelets more or less wrapped up. So in reply to your question, I would say that semantics simply don't matter. The fact that Bush doesn't accept it's a civil war, that the fact that al-Maliki doesn't accept it is, doesn't change the reality. It's just as, you know, the Bush administration says that granting independence to Kosovo would not establish a precedent for Transnistria or Ossetia. Well, it will. What they say does not affect the reality on the ground.
At the same time, very briefly, Sergei, if the president contends, far from being a civil war, this is, we're watching the war on terror taking place, and he again today said that Iraq is a center in the war on terror. What do you make of that assessment?
Yes, it is indeed, because Iraq has provided an Allah-sent focal point to the jihadists of the world to, first of all, energize the animus, the animosity against the United States throughout the Muslim world. Secondly, to provide them a training ground and a grand stage for their actions. And thirdly, to get the United States bogged down in a quagmire that was not connected to 9/11, and that is effectively taking away the resources that would have been deployed much more usefully elsewhere for the real war on terrorism, which would entail also domestic policies that would prevent further influx of illegal immigrants. And Mr. Bush's continued intention to have amnesty under whatever name is certainly a step back in the war on terror.
So the big question is, what can be done to improve the situation in Iraq, given our present political situation now here in the United States?
It would take some kind of agreement between the parties that there should be at least the outline of a timetable. Obviously, the Democrats will not go along with the continued rhetoric of whatever it takes, as long as it takes, nothing less than victory, etc. So if they can agree on at least an outline of the timetable and the requirements in Iraq itself for the implementation of that timetable, it would be a step in the right direction. For as long as the Bush administration persisted in what was effectively an open-ended commitment, there was no light at the end of the tunnel. And in this respect, at least one could say that the result of Tuesday's election was not such a catastrophe.
If you were President Sergei Trifkovic of the United States, what would you do? What would your way forward be?
My focus would be primarily to find people within the Sunni community, people who are Iraqi nationalists rather than Islamic fundamentalists, and who are actively engaged in the insurgency, to have a stake in the resulting Iraqi order. That would also mean giving them a slice of the oil action. Now, not many people realize this, but the city of Kirkuk, which has some of the richest oil fields in Iraq, is a predominantly Arab city, even though it is now controlled by Kurds who want to make it the capital of their future state. Now, I would frankly use the rhetoric of self-determination to have some kind of plebiscite in Kirkuk so that it could be attached to the Sunni unit in a future confederal Iraq, in which the three communities would effectively run their own affairs, not have to fear whether the secret police controlled by the Shiites today would murder the Sunnis, just as the secret police under Saddam, controlled by Sunnis, used to murder the Shiites. In the end, what we need is an Iraq that can have three polities living side by side, not being at each other's throats, and not presenting a threat to the U.S. interests. That has nothing to do necessarily with democracy in the Middle East or with preserving Iraq's integrity. It simply has to do with pragmatic policy of disengagement. Amongst Saddam's old loyalists, there are many unsavory people. There are many Baathists with blood on their hands. But among them, I'm sure one has to find interlocutors for a dialogue without which the Sunni community will simply continue to resist. And for as long as you have 22% of the population embittered against the occupiers and feeling persecuted by the majority community, the Shiites, there will be no peace.
With only 30 seconds, Sergio, how much has the Bush administration underestimated the role that Islam as a religion plays in Iraq? And do you think that the new Democratic majority will recognize that role?
Well, the answer is they've underestimated it, and they haven't tried to drive the wedge between nationalist resistance and resistance. And as for the Democrats, anyone who hopes that they will grasp the essence of Islam and the threat of jihad may as well buy some real estate in Florida.
Dr. Sergio Trifkovic is foreign affairs editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. You can read Sergio Trifkovic's columns on the web at chroniclesmagazine.org, chroniclesmagazine.org. Dr. Trifkovic is also director of the Rockford Institute Center for International Affairs. Sergio, thank you for being our guest.
My pleasure as always.
When we come back from this break, a little bit of open lines for your questions and your comments. I do want to hear from you. We've heard from Sergio Trifkovic, from Congressman Shimkus, from various other guests already today, their reactions to the elections yesterday. I want to hear from you when we come back from this break. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issues@kfuo.org. Your opportunity to react to what we've said so far here today, and your opportunity to react as a voter to yesterday's elections. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Then coming up at about 525 for just a few minutes, Dennis DeMauro is going to join us, Northern Virginia Lutherans for Life. He heard with his own ears the arguments today by the Supreme Court on Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. He was there in the chamber while the arguments were being made. We'll find out what he had to say about what went on in the Supreme Court today. Jackie Winship, Executive Director of Missourians Against Human Cloning, will join us for the last 15 minutes to reflect upon yesterday's passage of Amendment 2 here in Missouri. That's all coming up after this break. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Regardless of the political winds here or abroad, LCMS World Relief keeps its eyes on those who are most in need. And at the current world situation, that means it has to look far and afield and to many different victims, to many different people in need of help. LCMS World Relief underwrites Issues, etc. You can find it on our website, issuesetc.org. Or you can donate directly to LCMS World Relief, where 95% of your relief dollar goes directly to the victims. 1-888-930-4438. 1-888-930-4438. Your phone calls and your email on yesterday's election right after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.